issues affecting Asia's animals and the stories of the people working on their behalf. We'll be taking you on a tour of what's been happening lately in the animal protection space around Asia, and also bringing you updates from our huge network of animal protection organizations and our many working groups. Welcome to the Asia for Animals podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a brand new episode of the Asia for Animals podcast. My name is Pavitra, and I'm a coordinator at the Capacity in Animal Protection Coalition under AFA. I am super thrilled to be hosting today's podcast because not just do we have a brand new working group announcement, but we also have an incredible, incredible speaker who's joining us today to talk more about this working group. Now, before we get into who the speaker is, let me introduce One Life, which is a brand new branch of our work at AFA and mainly focuses on animal sentience education in order to guide animal lovers as they discover how they can better help the animals around them. One Life would be a centralized collection of resources designed to provide NGOs free access to educational materials to tackle an array of issues and problems about animal sentience. These resources would include articles, infographics, presentation templates with pre-written scripts that can be adapted, rebranded, and even translated so they can be used by member NGOs to introduce the concept of One Life in their own regions. One Life will also focus on strategies that target common, well-intentioned, but very often damaging behaviors like inappropriate wildlife feeding and engagement with online animal cruelty content. Now, one of the mainstays of One Life will also be the focus on trainings on animal sentience, behavior, and animal welfare. And to speak more on that, we have none other than David Neal, aka Dave Neal, as we all know him, from Animals Asia. And we're so grateful to have him speak on the program because One Life is essentially Dave's brainchild. Dave is the Animal Welfare Director for the Animals Asia Foundation and leads a series of animal welfare campaigns aimed at improving the welfare of captive wild animals in China and Vietnam, working in partnership with government wildlife rescue centers and zoos to implement management training initiatives for animal managers and vets. He also leads campaigns to end the use of animals in circuses and to end elephant riding tourism in Vietnam, and has established the country's first ethical elephant tourism experience in partnership with the Yok Don National Park. David has a particular interest in education and has developed a capacity-building education program promoting the concepts of animal sentience, emotions, and cognition within the teaching curriculums in China and Vietnam. Dave regularly delivers lectures on animal welfare issues and the concepts of sentience, emotions, and cognition, encouraging the public to develop a greater empathy for all animal species. He passionately believes that the route to tackling the widespread issues of animal suffering across the world lies in a greater understanding of animals as emotionally and cognitively complex individuals. So with that, hello and welcome to the AFA podcast, Dave.
Hi, thanks very much, Pavitra, and thanks very much for the introduction and for inviting me on the podcast. Pleasure to be here.
Likewise, Dave. So let's just jump right into the good stuff. We've all seen multiple organizations running animal welfare education programs, be it with schools or universities. So can you tell us the main difference between the One Life program that AFA now has and other animal welfare education programs?
Yeah, sure. Great question. And firstly, I think you need to say I value all kind of educational approaches. And education is given in many different ways by NGOs in different countries. But traditionally, I think a lot of our educational approaches have been sort of either campaign or issue led. So as organizations, as NGOs, then we have our own specific issues that we're working on. And often we've concentrated that education approach maybe either on that issue or raising awareness about that issue or about that species that we're working with to try to change people's behaviors. And we see within the media or within some of the public spaces, like if you go to zoos, then the information you receive is often sort of very very sort of factual information, and maybe about conservation status of an animal, geographical location, distribution. But what I felt was missing in a lot of this is that information about the animals themselves as individuals and how they experience the world themselves. Now, this comes into all of these different educational approaches, but up until recently, then there hasn't been an educational approach which is concentrated on that particular aspect. So the One Life program is really trying to sort of take people a step back. So before we start talking about maybe how an animal experiences something negatively, maybe if there's a welfare issue we're trying to address, maybe we're going into a school or a community and saying, you know, this animal is experiencing poor welfare because of these reasons, maybe what we need to do is explain how that animal experiences the world, what its emotional capacities are, first of all, and then relate that particular experience to those emotional capacities. So it's really trying to sort of get people to take a step back. So the whole of the One Life program is really concentrating around these different themes. Firstly, the fact that animals are sentient, so they have feelings, so they can experience pain and they can experience pleasure, but also those emotional experiences of happiness and joy, how deep they are in some animals as well, you know. So some animals have more of an optimistic outlook on life, and other individuals have more of a pessimistic outlook on life, just like we do as individuals. Certain species have incredibly complex social relationships, which means that if an individual is lost within that social group, then others it impacts others very negatively. And again, relating that to maybe how we experience things when we lose people within our own families. And so really it was trying to look at just the depth of those emotional connections between individuals, so that hopefully that then can sort of get people to understand a little bit more about why some of the behaviors that we're asking animals to do, or we're forcing animals to do, might be causing them to suffer. And then people would hopefully empathize with those animals a little bit more. But then it's also to try to get people to think a little bit more about how an animal has evolved to live within its own world, and some of the things which, you know, some of the capacities that it has, the cognitive abilities, the problem solving abilities, the tool use abilities, the memory capacities of animals. I think these are things which we don't generally talk about very often in sort of public arenas. So, you know, you can pick almost any species and there'll be some amazing cognitive feats that these individual animals that have evolved to have to be able to live within their own world. And I think we need to get those across, to try to get people to maybe empathize with not just with some of the big sort of megafauna, with the elephants and the bears, which obviously is Animals Asia's main work, but also with some of the smaller species as well, you know. So some of the farmed animals, the fishes, and some of the invertebrates, and start looking a little bit across a much more diverse sort of range of species, and looking at those emotional and those cognitive abilities, and then using this educational approach to be able to sort of get that information out there. And this information is there, you know. There's so much behavioral research which is being carried out by amazing behavioral researchers across the world on these abilities, on just how complex animals are emotionally and cognitively. Yet I think at the moment we haven't really been able to sort of package that, as we're trying to do with One Life, into something that then sort of goes out in a public arena. And you know, I get quite frustrated watching things like natural history programs on the TV, because they start sort of talking about sort of social relationships, you know, in say lions, but then they go straight into the sort of predator prey relationship, you know, and it goes straight into the sort of like, well, and this is how they communicate with each other so they can go off and hunt, and then they cooperate to each other by pulling down this animal and killing it. And that is what they do, but you know, animals are much more complex than that. Like, majority of a lion's life is not spent hunting. The majority of that life is spent actually bonding with other individuals and developing really strong emotional bonds with each other. And really, I think those are the messages that, you know, just in this one example of lions in, you know, in the Serengeti, whenever they come up, whenever lions come up or any big predator comes up in a natural history program, it's always about that one aspect of their life, how they hunt and how they kill. And we miss out all of these other real important intricacies of their lives by not looking at them as individuals and how they operate outside of that one aspect of their life. But and that you can take any single species, and we really look at it from a very narrow focus. We really need to broaden that focus hugely to look at all of their cognitive abilities and all of those emotional and social experiences that they have, so that we can get a better understanding of those animals, so that when we then ask people to maybe change their behavior towards those animals, whether that be, you know, not riding elephants or not going to circuses in the case of some of the areas that I work in, or maybe, you know, changing your diet towards eating less animals or towards a more plant-based diet, then maybe people have a better understanding of those animals and how they experience their world and can empathize with them a little bit more, and then maybe want to change their behaviors towards much more positively towards those animals.
Absolutely. I think overall, it's always been, you know, animal welfare. And as you said, like facts and figures, whenever we, even within the movement, that's how we talk. And animal sentience as a concept has never been the focal point. And I mean, I remember sitting through your presentation at the Asia for Animals conference in Kuching, Malaysia. And it was just so interesting to hear about, you spoke about the behavior of hens and, you know, how they feel, how they express their emotions, be it joy, be it anger. And it was just so interesting. And there were just so many points that we can use in our daily advocacy. For example, when we speak about cage-free campaigns, we are usually talking about the size of the cages or how the hens should be kept, mainly coming from a welfare perspective, which undeniably is extremely important. But I also feel like adding animal sentience as part of the campaign really adds a lot of depth and nuance to what we're saying. And this definitely becomes quite important and has the potential to literally shift the narrative and shift how we are thinking about creating these campaigns. So coming back to your presentation, I think it would be really interesting. I mean, I've heard these examples, but I think it'll be interesting for our listeners to also get a glimpse of the kinds of examples that you share in your presentations when it comes to, you know, animal sentience.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, hopefully, this is information that, you know, some may or may not know. But the type of sort of messages that we're trying to get across, obviously, is just how complex the individual animals are. And one of the recent presentations I gave was about fishes and just how complex fish are as individuals. And One particular example is with a fish called the cleaner wrasse. So the cleaner wrasse is a fish which creates these sort of stations within within the sort of coral reef, and fish come to it to be cleaned. So they clean off all of the dead skin and the parasites of those particular fish. So firstly, the fish which come to the cleaner wrasse is a very small fish. And the fish which come to be cleaned are often quite large. And some of those fish can actually be predators of the cleaner wrasse. So firstly, there'll be some sort of communication between the two individuals that this is going to be a non-predator prey relationship, because obviously there's no good if the cleaner wrasse is just eaten. The client fish is basically, you know, saying, look, I come in peace. And they communicate that and they understand that. And so firstly, there's that I think is quite amazing that, you know, these two individuals away from these stations may actually be predator prey, actually can have this individual relationship. The cleaner wrasse will then clean that individual, and not just clean sort of the outside of that individual, will even go inside the mouth of that individual. So go into the most dangerous position, because that communication and that trust between the individuals has been built up through that initial communication. And the fish, which is maybe a predator, needs to be cleaned, right? They need to have those parasites removed. So it's doing them a favor. So that in itself, I think, is quite incredible, that this relationship between the two individuals. But what is even more incredible is that the cleaner rats often operate as pairs. So there's two cleaner rats that do the cleaning. And there's always a temptation, although from the cleaner rats to take maybe a bite of the flesh of the fish, because that's obviously very nutritious. So even though, you know, it's a dangerous thing to do, there's a temptation for them maybe to do it. And if one of them does it, the likelihood is that fish will just swim away. Like it's not going to be sitting there, you know, it gets a bit of a bite. It's not going to just stand for that. It's just going to swim away. And if it does, what generally happens then is the other individual that didn't do the biting will reprimand, will go and tell off the one that did. It will go and chase it, and it will basically say, you've just lost our feeding opportunity because of what you just did. But what is even more impressive than that is the individual who then didn't do the biting is, in some cases, and there's video evidence of this, of them going after their client fish to ask them to come back to the cleaning station. So to effectively apologize on behalf of the other fish for what it just did, for causing it a little bit of pain. And they do this by giving them a fin massage. So they actually they swim up and down their fins in a way which they wouldn't do normally. And again, this, you know, we're interpreting the meaning of this, but it's likely that that is kind of just saying, look, you know, this is something nice for you. It's a pleasurable experience. And the fish then kind of thinks, okay, I start to trust you again. And then hopefully they'll come back into that situation. So just something as simple as that involves incredibly complex communication between two different fish, but then an understanding of fairness and an understanding of sort of moral behavior, right? To understanding that one individual has done something wrong, and that another individual not only reprimands that individual, but then may actually go off and try to sort of woo this fish back into the situation. So that's the sort of information which I find amazing, fascinating. You know, researchers are discovering this information. It's really complex emotional experiences and social experiences between these individuals, and that's the sort of information which I think we should be putting out there. I'll give you another example in pigs, and a really nice experiment, which a behavioral experiment which was done in Bristol University some years ago, which was looking at whether pigs could understand whether another pig had more information than them or not. Now, this is something, you know, within ourselves, or we often call it theory of mind or perspective taking. So we know ourselves, if somebody else has more information than us, that maybe we have to follow that individual to get to the point where we want to go to, because we don't have that information. So this is the sort of thing that's being tested behaviorally. And in these pigs, it was tested with pairing two pigs together. So there was a large pig and a smaller pig, and there was a field, and food was being dropped behind sort of barriers within the field, but only the small pig could see where the food was being dropped. So the larger pig could see the small pig, but there was a barrier up. We couldn't see where the food was being dropped. And then these two pigs would be allowed to released into the field to find the food. And of course, the larger pig would just go, you know, randomly searching, following his nose to find the food. But the smaller pig, who knew where the food was, would go straight to the food sources. So after a few trials with this, what they found was that the large pig started to understand that the small pig knew more than him. And all he had to do was follow the small pig. He didn't have to randomly search for the food. He just had to follow the small pig to get to the food. So that was really demonstrating that a pig can understand another individual has more information than themselves. So taking the perspective of that pig. But what was really fascinating about this was that, so what would happen then, once the large pig realized the small pig knew where the food was, he would follow him straight to the food. And because he was larger, then he would butt him out of the way, and he would really, you know, he would take that food, and the small pig would then have to go and find another food source. And of course, the smaller pigs are always going to the large food dumps, you know, the biggest ones first of all. So what the smaller pig then started to do in some cases was it started to realize that it was losing out. So what it started to do was, rather than going to the big food dumps, it would start to lead the large pig to the smaller food dumps, knowing the large pig would then butt it out, and then it would go off and go to the large food dump where he knew that there was more valuable food available. So again, just really interesting kind of thought processes and actions that these individuals are taking to be able to understand that another one individual has information, but then also to be able to just kind of deceive those individuals once you've understood that they know everything that you know. So again, I think, you know, those kind of messages, it's all done through behavioral research. It's all out there in sort of scientific publications, but you know, we need to bring those messages into this sort of educational arena so that people can maybe get a much better understanding of the animals that we're talking about. Because, you know, generally when you talk about these things and you put this information across, people don't know it already, and they're quite fascinated by the fact that fish can have moral behaviors and can understand fairness, and that pigs can, one, understand the perspective of another, but also can then deceive individuals to get a better reward for themselves.
Well, much smarter than a lot of humans, though very conscious that I shouldn't be making this comparison.
yeah, it possibly is the case. And I mean, you actually raise a good point, but it's, I think one of the things we have to be careful with this program is that we're not sort of trying to compare individual species with each other. And I know that wasn't what you were trying to do there, but it is a good point in that I do try to avoid, and I think the program, you know, needs to avoid going down that who is the most intelligent, because essentially, you know, animals have evolved to be intelligent within their own environment. And so they have their own type of intelligence, which is very different to ours. A fish's intelligence is very different to a cow's or a human's, because they live in a completely different environment. But it is important to be able to understand their own sort of level of cognition and intelligence, and what they need for their own environment, and how they then express that within that environment. But yeah, I think it is fascinating information. So
definitely, I think my next question is around the whole idea of One Life as a concept, and I know you just explained how there was a gap between or nobody was talking about animal sentience as a concept. What was the history of the ideation of the concept, and now reaching to a point where it's a program of its own?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's really a journey which I've gone on over many years. And I've been working with Animals Asia now for over 20 years, and working in China and Vietnam on a number of different campaigns, which are mainly involving captive wild animals. And really, I guess in my first few years of working on those campaigns, then I did like most people do with campaign work. I was, you know, out there documenting the things which were happening and documenting the suffering of animals in various situations, and then putting that together in reports and video footage, and trying to sort of get that information out there in that sort of traditional way that we do, and what we need to continue to do. But I think over time, when you do that for many, many years, you start to realize that there has to be more to it than just sort of collecting that data and collecting all this information, when you see that some of that suffering doesn't really change. And also when you see sort of new generations as well, so, you know, going to some sort of zoos and safari parks and circuses, you see young children, you know, and then you go back 5 years later and there's young children there again. You think something's missing here, because the same, even though we might have reached some of those that, you know, that were there 5 years ago, there's a new batch coming in and they're watching animals in circuses and without really having this understanding of how animals are experiencing that particular moment themselves. And so that was why I kind of wanted to take it back and say, look, you know, let's not just go in and talk about it's wrong to have an animal, like a wild animal, like a bear or an elephant in a circus, but let's talk about how bears experience life in general, in how they would experience it in the wild and how elephants experience it in the wild. And then hopefully people will make the connections themselves. And that's then led on to doing the same with some of the farmed animals. And you mentioned, you know, the presentation that I gave in one of the conferences that you were at, where, you know, rather than just talking about hens and the suffering that they go through when they're in factory farms or intensive pig farming, etc., you know, let's try to get people to empathize with those animals as individuals. And welfare has to be a part of it. Welfare is a crucial part of it. And welfare, explaining, you know, what welfare is and explaining how an animal's welfare is being compromised and how it can be improved is, you know, is our main goal of as animal welfare organizations. But I do think we do have to take that step back and really try to get people to understand the animals themselves, and then they'll make the connection to why their welfare is bad, because they hopefully can understand that their experience is similar, and certainly shouldn't be compared to, but it's similar to our own experience in terms of, you know, if we're put into a situation where we can't express those ourselves emotionally, cognitively, and socially. And so I changed the way that I worked a little bit within Animals Asia. So going away directly from just campaign work to this educational approach and to bringing in these messages of emotions and cognition into our general kind of work that we were working with, whoever we were working with. So if we were working in schools, but we're also working a number with zoo educators in China in particular. We've got very good relationships. We do a lot of training for zookeepers in China in terms of animal management. So we also are connected with the educators. So we're trying to sort of ask those educators to learn a little bit more, raise awareness about this type of information, these concepts, and then promote those within their own educational work. And the idea of One Life really came about because we're trying to talk about animals as individuals, so rather than just talking about a group of animals, so how hens experience the world or how bears experience the world, how one individual experiences the world, and then trying to concentrate people's minds, I guess, onto that one individual so that you can relate to that individual a little bit more than maybe a group of animals. And I think this is something which is important, particularly for farmed animals, because, you know, the numbers are usually so huge. So whether it be farmed hens or whether it be farmed fishes, you know, the numbers of animals, when you're seeing the pictures, it's often huge numbers of animals, and trying to sort of get people to understand them as that one individual is experiencing the world in this way will hopefully help people to sort of get a better idea of that. So that was how the idea of One Life came about, because the presentations that I sort of gave were really starting with, let's think about this individual. It has just one life. It doesn't have a second chance. But whatever happens to this individual is going to be its life. And so we have a responsibility to try to allow that animal to live the best life possible that it can do. So that was really where the sort of One Life concept came from. And we've been delivering that within Animals Asia for a number of years, and I'm really pleased now to say that that we're transferring that into Asia for Animals, so that we can broaden that out now across the Asia region, because, you know, the information doesn't belong to anybody. It's the content, the information is put together by myself, but it could be put together by others. You know, I'm not out there doing the research on this. I'm really just collecting other people's research and then putting it into a format that we can then use either through blog posts, or we can use as part of educational programs. And so it's publicly available information, which was why we said, well, it would be really good now to extend this and use it. So Animals Asia will continue to run this educational approach, and we'll continue to produce content and deliver that content in China and in Vietnam. But we will also share the content with Asia for Animals, but as part of the One Life program, and hopefully other organizations may do similar, so that it can then be used by more organizations across the region.
Thank you so much, Dave. I think that's going to be really, really helpful for so many of the Asia for Animals network members, because we have been having so many conversations, and there have been requests for such material to be made available. And given that AFA is such a huge network, I think we are in a position to do that now through your support. So thank you so much for that. Now, coming to the trainings, we know that over the years you have been giving multiple trainings on animal sentience to people from different age groups. So how has the response been like? And also, in line with that question, one of the things we want to do under One Life program is to work, of course, on education for children, because we truly believe that fostering strong ethics and a sense of compassion at an early age is probably one of the strongest ways to shape a kinder world in the future. So how, if you could just talk a little bit about your experience on working and educating children in particular on animal sentience.
Yeah, sure. And again, a great question. And it's incredibly important, obviously, to be able to try to encourage children to be able to understand these messages. And actually, I think the the problem we have as a society is that we actually sort of, children do, I think, understand these messages quite readily if they're allowed to. Children generally, I've got two relatively young children, and you know, when they were growing up, they both, you know, had an immediate empathy for animals. Now they're in a situation where, you know, they're in a family which is very empathetic towards animals. But I think just in general, you know, all of the sort of imagery about animals that we use with children is all very positive. Children have a real association and an empathy with animals. Generally then, as they sort of get older, in a sense, that's kind of ripped apart. It's taken away from them, because society kind of uses animals in so many different ways, and then we tell children it's acceptable to use animals in those ways, and so that sort of connection and that sort of understanding of animals as being individuals is sort of lost. So this is really trying to sort of bring that back, I think, and to try to give children that understanding of animals a little bit more sense, so they can question some of the things which society is doing. You know, I mean, even, you know, you kids go to school, right, and they trust their teachers, but their teachers are the ones then who are saying, well, you know, this is the food that you should eat here in school, and that food is will generally be, you know, from factory farmed individuals and, you know, meat and dairy. And so instantly it's like the people that they're trusting are the ones that are sort of telling them to do something which is leading to animals to suffer, when actually if the children sort of had more information, they may actually stand up to say, well, actually I don't think we should be doing that because of these reasons. And then, you know, maybe we can change that narrative. And so that's why it's important to be talking to children in particular. It's really important to be talking to adults, because it's the children go home and they're the adults, that the parents, that they're then going to and saying, well, you know, I've just learned from the classroom, the lesson that I've had, that, you know, hens are incredibly complex and that they have these really individual bonds with each other and blah, blah, blah. And it's difficult then, if the parent really doesn't have that understanding as well, for them to turn around and say, okay, great, you know, we'll completely stop eating chicken. You know, it sort of creates a conflict. So you have to kind of put out information across the board to hopefully try to get people involved in different levels, but also to give the children the support that they then need if they're going to question things like either, you know, their dietary habits, or, you know, going to the zoo or going to a circus or riding an elephant, things like that. So we've kind of delivered these messages. I've delivered them personally more to adult audiences, and I think they find it fascinating, some of the information which comes out of it, because you kind of think, you know, maybe people know this information, and generally you find that they don't. So, you know, most people know that, you know, animals like hens and pigs and are sentient animals and can experience positive and negative emotions, but maybe they just don't know the depth of that. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, you learned a lot just from listening to some of the information that was delivered through that presentation at the conference. So it's getting those messages out, and we generally find that the feedback from people is really, really positive in terms of them learning something new about either individual animals or lots of different animals from that information. But obviously the children are the ones that we really have concentrated that information on. And at the moment, most of our work, well, the most of the delivery has been in China, within communities within China, with educators who have got experience of delivering environmental education to groups of children within their community. We've empowered those educators to deliver this information as well. And the feedback that we've had from the surveys has always been really positive, and that, you know, children have gained a much greater understanding of emotional capacities of animals and of a range of animals. So not just the large mammals and the birds, but also, you know, the fishes and the invertebrates as well. It's difficult to say whether that changes behavior, because that's a really difficult thing to monitor in groups that you're not sort of, you know, that you don't work with on a regular basis. But hopefully from just seeing that people understand the information, then hopefully it will lead to some behavior changes in the future. So yeah, I think it's really important that we continue to try to get it either into the curriculum of schools, but that's always very difficult, but certainly to produce a curriculum or a series of lesson plans that people can pick up and give to educators within their community, and those educators can then deliver to children in whatever format that is. So if that's formal education in schools, if teachers can have got that capacity to do that, then absolutely great. If they don't, because sometimes teachers are so constrained by the curriculum that they have to deliver, you know, set by the various governments, then they hopefully it can be delivered as a community education program in the community centers where children are receiving different information in it. And often that works because it's often done in a less formal setting. So it's a much more sort of fun setting, maybe after school clubs or weekend clubs, which aren't quite as formal as a school setting. But that's certainly, you know, the hope that we as Animals Asia will continue to do that in China and continue to work on doing that in Vietnam. But hopefully the resources that we produce can then be used throughout the Asia region with people either working in schools or within communities to deliver the same messages.
Absolutely. And I know it's very difficult to sort of monitor human behavior change, as you said, but I am pretty sure, because I remember how moved I was with your presentation, so I'm pretty sure it's having an impact. And the more information there is and the more information that goes out, especially now through the program, we're sure that it has a lot of scope, because nobody else is doing this kind of work, even within the animal welfare movement across Asia. So there is definitely a lot of scope to work around. And now coming back to wildlife in AFA, so what is your hope for the future of the program at AFA?
Yeah, I think the potential for this program to grow is huge. As you say, it's not really something which is currently out there as an educational program. There's lots of parts of it which are definitely being used by organizations across the world to change people's opinions about animals. But as a sort of a whole concept, I don't think there's currently one. So hopefully we can develop it much more into this whole concept. We certainly need then to be able to promote it further. You know, we need a coordinator for the working group to be able to then bring all this information together and help to disseminate it. We're going to need things like translations being done to make sure that this information is available. Obviously, I'm writing this information in English. We've got some of our teams in China who deliver some of this information, some in Vietnam. So some of this information is already being translated into those two languages. But, you know, there are so many different languages across the Asia region that really this information needs to be translated into to be able to make sure that it's effective. So for the potential to run this education program across Asia in many different countries, in many different regions, is huge. But it really does require the funding of a coordinator within the Asia for Animals team for it to get going, because, you know, my part is very much sort of producing content, and I will continue to do that. And I do that for the teams that I currently work with as part of Animals Asia. But you know, I can't be the one who's then coordinating the dissemination of this to as part of the Asia for Animals. So we definitely need some support to be able to get a person in place who then coordinates all of this. And, you know, hopefully we'll find other organizations that are maybe already delivering something similar to this that they can also bring into this program. So it doesn't need to rely on myself and the content that I have. It can bring in other organizations' educational approaches, because I'm sure there are aspects of that within that, and then make those available across to all organizations working within Asia, in the hope that, you know, these messages start to go out, you know, in much greater numbers than they currently do, just working with it all sort of sitting within one organization.
Yes. So a shout out to any funding or grant making body who would like to contribute, or any organization in general who would like to contribute to the One Life program. Please do get in touch with us. You can write to us on our email ID. That's info@asiaforanimals.com, and we'll be sure to get in touch with you. All right, so with that, we've come to an end to this wonderful podcast. Thank you so much, Dave, for being a part of this. It's been incredible to learn about the you know, how you brought One Life to life. And thank you so much for trusting AFA to take this project on. And we sure hope to deliver on it and make it reach as many organizations as possible. So thank you so much once again, Dave.
Yeah, thanks, Pavitra. It's good. It's been good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening. You can find everything you need to know about our work and connect with us at asiaforanimals.com. Tune in for the next episode. Asia for Animals Coalition, a united voice for Asia's animals.